Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
I have probably the most abstract presentation, and we save it for the end of the day, so thank you for bearing with me. Let me make a couple of housekeeping points before I start. First, you may wonder if you looked at my bio, although there's not much in the program, why Foucault? And I must say that when I was at university at Berkeley, I wrote a senior honors thesis on Foucault, and so I've had a lifelong interest in his work. And the opportunity to present on Foucault related to international criminal law was intriguing to me. Secondly, related to that, and I want to connect, and I think this is what's great about these SILRAP conferences, when the call for papers came out and I thought about Foucault, the other thing I thought about was a presentation that was made here in 2014 for the historical origins of international criminal law by Mark Lewis. And I immediately sort of put the two together and I thought, wow, wouldn't it be neat? And it turns out that it's right here in New Delhi that we could have a presentation that could incorporate a little bit of Mark Lewis with the philosophical foundations. So that was another thing. What I'm going to do is really briefly go through the history. You can see in my overview of Foucault's life, his philosophical works. I'm going to do that pretty quickly because I want to give you some context, but I want to spend more time on the international criminal law implications of this notion of governmentality. So I'll talk about the prevailing view of Foucault in international criminal law scholarship, which my goal is to move beyond that and have you hopefully look at it from a deeper perspective. The other thing I wanted to say is that this is a work in progress. So I'm still kind of working through some of these things. So there's a little bit of a caveat. But I'm going to give you my thoughts as I've gotten them together as of today. And then I'm going to look at the very thing that Mark Lewis kind of inspired in me, along with Janya Turner, a scholar from SMU, which is this notion of transnational networking and international criminal law. And then I'll kind of relate that back to governmentality and I'll wrap it up. So Foucault is someone who grew up, if you will, under the rule of Nazi occupation. He was born in 1926. So I think that's something that marks him, and I think I'll talk about that in the paper. I won't go into it much now, but I think it's worth keeping in the back of your mind. He came from a family of doctors, another thing that I think is worth pointing out is that in some ways he was an historian really before he was a philosopher. In many respects, philosophy was somewhat incidental to his historical explorations. We see that when he looks at the history of madness, he looks at the birth of the clinic, he looks at the origins of prisons and whatnot. And then another thing that I just want to throw out there is that he's a huge devotee of the works of Friedrich Nietzsche. And at a time in the academy, especially when he was at École Normale Supérieure, and you had people like Althusser who were fanatics of Marx. There was a huge Marxist contingent post-World War II. Thank you. It bears notice that Foucault was looking at Nietzsche and he was trying to get out of Marxist thought, if you will, and strike out on his own, and Nietzsche was important in that regard. Let me just talk briefly about his life. As I said, he was born in Poitiers. He went to the best university in France, which was the École Normale Supérieure. He got degrees not just in philosophy, but also in psychology and psychoanalytics. He finished in 52. He taught at Lille and at ENS. And then he had a time in his life where he traveled. He went to Stockholm, he went to Warsaw, he went to Hamburg. And that's really when he did a lot of the research that resulted in his PhD thesis, which was on the history of madness. That was defended in 61, at which time he came back to France and started to teach in France. And ultimately, he went back to Tunisia, so he had a very kind of a peripatetic existence, and then back to France again after the great upheaval in 1968. And was elected to the Collège de France, which is the greatest honor that a scholar in France can have, and which meant that he would give a series of lectures every year. And that's important because I'm going to talk about one of those lectures, one of those courses that he gave. It's important to put that into perspective. Once a year, he would give a course, which consisted of about 13 lectures on a topic. He was nominated as a professor of systems of thought. So that's what he did, and that's what he did for the rest of his life, with some travel to the United States. Sadly, and in his bio, I should mention that he was always interested in hospitals. He was homosexual. He struggled with that at a time when it had to be in the closet. He tried to commit suicide on more than one occasion, and he himself was institutionalized. So he studied hospitals both as a patient, and then when he was at university, he studied psychiatric institutions as part of his education. Let me then talk about his work. And we start with the doctoral thesis, History of Madness, as I point out. It was actually published as a book, and in it he posits that the distinction between madness and sanity is strictly an historical construct fabricated by the Enlightenment to cover for controlling challenges to conventional bourgeoisie morality. So you still have a little bit of Marxist tinge there. From there, he gets into his archaeology books, quote unquote. And generally what I would say about these archaeology books is that they tend to be very epistemic. In fact, he talks about something called the episteme, which is the body of knowledge that builds around a certain area of study. And he's interested in what I would say Thomas Kuhn, and really this is somewhat Kuhn avant la lettre, would call paradigm shifts. The two of them are kind of working together. I'm happy and proud to say that Kuhn was writing his great book on paradigm shifts, the scientific revolutions at Berkeley. And then Foucault would later come back at Berkeley, so I feel great pride as a Berkeley grad. But this was kind of his focus. And so he begins with the birth of the clinic, which looks at general, you know, more medical issues as opposed to just psychiatric. And he talks about the gaze. So he talks about the fact that this medical gaze, the act of scrutinizing a patient inductively based on observation, strictly on observation of the individual body as an object without adulterating the diagnosis with pre-Enlightenment cultural heuristics or identity politics. So he's really trying to get down to the nub of what the texts that he researched are saying about how medical diagnosis took place. He follows that up with The Order of Things, an Archaeology of Human Sciences from 1966. And this tracks shifts in collective knowledge paradigms over time. Again, the episteme, somewhat like Thomas Kuhn, but branches out to the disciplines of biology, linguistics, and economics. And this resonated with what Claude Lévi-Strauss was doing as an anthropologist in terms of structuralism. So a lot of people talk about Foucault as a post-structuralist. I don't know that I agree with that. I think there's a lot of structuralism in Foucault. Shannon and I can debate that later. But in any event, he became a celebrity in France with this book. And then he followed it up with The Archaeology of Knowledge in 1969, where he proposes really a pure methodological, ahistorical guideline or set of guidelines to conduct the kind of discursive analysis that he did in The Order of Things. Okay, so that's his archaeological period. We then move on to his genealogical books. Remember I said he was a big fan of Nietzsche. This notion of genealogy, he gets from Nietzsche. And what he's doing now is instead of just looking at a body of discourse, he's analyzing that discourse through what people in power are actually doing with it. So it becomes the institutional production of discourse that interests him. And this is where he authors the books for which he's most famous, beginning with Discipline and Punish in 1975. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time on that because it's important to understand the context of governmentality, which I want to focus on. But this is an account of how the modern era avoided torture and execution, which were the older modes of castigation, to develop a more gentle method of punishing criminals, i.e. imprisoning them. And on the surface, everyone thought, well, that's a more enlightened way of doing it. That's a more civilized way of doing it. But what Foucault actually showed was that there was something somewhat almost pernicious and negative about it. And that is embodied in the notion of panopticism. So we heard about Bentham, and we heard the positive account of Bentham. This, if you will, is more the negative account of Bentham. And it tells us that on a larger societal level, we see a shift from the exercise of sovereign power, or what he also refers to as juridico-legal power. And he gives the famous example of Damien, the regicide, who tried to kill Louis XV at the beginning of the book and was tortured hideously. And he gives a very compelling account of that. And then he compares that with about a century, not quite a century later, with the protocols of a prison, where there's all this uniformity and there's all this sort of notion of normalizing prisoners. And he talks about this as disciplinary power. Okay, so this is very important. So we've talked about juridico-legal power and then disciplinary power. This is kind of an evolution that he's seen. And he goes on to say that this kind of power is actually all over, right? So the prison is a good example of it, but it's only one. And what we can do is we can look at different institutions. We can look at schools. We can look at factories. We can look at hospitals, and we can see this way that power diffuses into every sector of what the institution does and creates a kind of uniformity with supervisors looking at, all the time at what employees are doing or what soldiers are doing in a military unit or what students are doing in a school. And he calls this the microphysics of power. As an aside, I would say my way of understanding this is it's not, and I'll talk about this in a moment, it's not necessarily strictly a nefarious operation that's coming from a central power, but rather it's kind of the implication of the modernity of society. And it almost, for me, feels like systems theory. To me, that's what power is about on this level. It's kind of like systems theory. Carl Lumens, I think, would be an interesting study vis-a-vis this kind of power. Okay, so that's disciplinary power. He then carries on with that in his last trilogy of books, which are The History of Sexuality. I'm not going to focus on volumes 2 and 3. I'm going to focus on volume 1. And he talks about some of the same things that he talked about with discipline and punish, but vis-a-vis sexuality. And he even talks about how the church uses confessionals such that we're not now only looking at the power that's exerted by a supervisor, say, over an employee, but also the power that one exerts over oneself through confession. The other thing that's really important, before I move to that next slide, is the notion of biopower. And he talks about this at the end of Volume 1. And there are two aspects of biopower to Foucault. The first is the body as a machine. It's disciplining. It's optimization of its capacities as it fits into overall society. And then the second, which has big implications for what I'm about to say, is a biopolitics of the population. Okay? So this is things like births, mortality, the level of health, life expectancy. So this is focusing on a much more macro level. And now we're talking about the macro physics of power. And all these types of power, sovereign power, disciplinary power, and if you will, biopower, they work together. So how do we link this to existing scholarship on Foucault and ICL? In the paper, I cite Pat O'Malley and Mariana Valverde's excellent 2014 piece, Foucault, Criminal Law, and the Governmentalization of the State. And their point is that Anglophone criminological scholarship on Foucault has a near obsession with discipline that has resulted in a reductive and distorted perspective that channels Marxist themes of exploitation and oppression. And frankly, ICL scholarship is a piece with this. And I give an example of a Northwestern University Law article. I'll give one quote for purposes of time.
This political economy bureaucratizes and normalizes punishment, thereby inserting it deeply into the now globalized social body. Although Foucault's discussion is limited to punishment by the state, I would apply his heuristic to the new and additional layers of bureaucratization contemplated by the emerging punitive arm of the superstate of international organizations. Essentially, what this is saying is it's taking disciplinary power and it's essentially supersizing it on a supranational scale. And I would posit that that is a superficial analysis of the way Foucault's thought evolved. And that's why it's important to look at his turn toward governmentality. Now, this was sketched out in Security Territory Population, and it springs from the regulatory implications of biopower. And its goal is the security of the multitudes. And it's the population that counts. And so he talks about problems with pandemics, famine, war. And in the form of the modern rational state, governmentality consists of a series of techniques that includes procedures, analyses, reflections, calculations, and tactics meant to protect the well-being of the population. And more than just seeking security, Foucault notes that it strives for freedom, which he characterizes as liberty from the abuses of the sovereign. And it implicates use of police, which he talks about a lot, as well as diplomacy. And that suggests that it's compatible with international criminal law. And I'll skip this quote from Joanna Oksala, but basically what she's saying in this is that there is not a negative notion of power that Foucault is looking at when he's looking at governmentality. He's looking, in fact, at ways that the positive aspects of power can benefit the population. And so I think what we can look at is an overall diagram, which you see here. We have the state, and we have institutions where disciplinary power functions. The state is over that. The state ensures disciplinary power works through sovereign power, but it also assures security and freedom through governmentality over the entire population. And you see that in the schematic. Now, going to Mark Lewis. ICL, transnational networking. The idea that I got when I was here in 2014, I start by looking at the Congress of Vienna, and then ultimately the Geneva Convention of 1864. And I also look at Moynier, because Moynier wanted to propose that court, as we heard earlier, and it was rejected. But in the paper, I talk about the network that was formed in connection with his efforts, which included Gustave Roland Jacquemin's. And then I look at another network with Vespasian Pella and Hugh Ballot. And then ultimately, there will be another one with Raphael Lemkin. These series of networks lead up ultimately to creation of the International Criminal Court. And I quote Mark Lewis, "These legal projects have dealt with security, the concept that persons involved in international war or affected by one, wounded or sick soldiers, medical personnel, and civilians under occupation should be secure from further unnecessary violence. That criminal prosecution could be used to secure international peace by preventing war itself." This echoes Foucault's concerns regarding the population and security. And then, as I said, Janya Yoncheva-Turner, her seminal article, Transnational Networks and International Criminal Justice, it fast forwards to the present time and explains how these transnational networks have reached maturity and are functioning very well. So what we have here is then when we come back to that schematic that I looked at earlier, and we can look at governmentality in the context of international criminal law, we see not just one state, but we see a series of states that represent the international community. We still see the notion of sovereign power and disciplinary power because Foucault stresses that those continue to operate alongside governmentality, and then we see the entire population. And this helps explain why I think Foucault's thought is compatible with the notion of the growth of ICL. So in conclusion, what I would say is that Foucault's thinking evolved from the microphysics to the macrophysics of power, from discipline to governmentality. And his notion of governmentality featured aspects of diplomacy, police, and security for populations, which are compatible with the rise of international criminal law. The rise of international criminal law came not from the top down, as existing ICL scholarship might suggest, but rather from the bottom up. And that's what I think the transnational networks show. And so at a time when the legitimacy of international criminal law is being questioned, this new way, I submit to you, of theorizing it could have important salutary implications. So instead of just looking at, well, international criminal law is all about individual criminal responsibility, as opposed to using the veil of the state, versus international criminal law is all about this imperialistic enterprise and they're just going after Africa, which I think is way too reductive anyway. This finds a middle ground and says, look at Foucault's philosophy and help theorize on a deeper level and understand how it's about security of vulnerable populations. And so I hope when you read my paper that that will come together and you'll see it, and that we can look at Foucault in a new light. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to SILRAP.org.